Questions?
What was the one we were having trouble with? Oh, yeah, I'd have to ask you, like, when I have it up on the computer.
Okay.
It's like a, so that probability current one?
Oh, yeah.
To define the probability current, we got zero. Then it asked which direction it's flowing, so I'm assuming we did it wrong if we got zero.
Yeah, so it's for like an e to the ikx or something like that.
That's what the answer is.
No, I can't remember the exact problem. So you're finding the probability current for psi equals e to the ikx or something like that.
Yeah.
And you should get not zero, and you should get something proportional to k, since k is the momentum. So it's like.
We should just rewrite that mathematical file and use k's, because of course c's were getting screwed up with the same k's and some
stuff. Actually, that's probably why.
So, I mean, in that particular problem, you've got complex conjugation, and Mathematica is kind of not good at complex conjugation.
Yeah. Well,
we just change the x, because the whole thing is.
That's a good way to do it. The complex conjugation function is about useless in Mathematica. Other questions? So we finished up chapter 3, which is to say we finished up what's going to be on the exam on Friday. And don't have to do it today, but I'm sure it comes as a great surprise to you that usually there's a help session that you vote on before the exam. So, I don't know, my guess is Thursday, Wednesday, something like that. And given how far people are behind, it might be that Thursday is a better choice than Wednesday, I don't know. And then there's a question of whether it's going to be 4-ish or 7-ish. It doesn't matter to me, and we're not voting on it, but what do you think it's going to turn out to be? Are people going to want to do it in the afternoon or in the evening?
Thursday. I'd probably prefer the evening.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, as I said, we're not voting on it yet. Just girding my loins.
What would be the... We had like a 4-0 vote for changing the exam to Monday. Would that be possible?
Sure, but yes, it's possible. So I often worry about Monday exams because people always assume. So I'm giving a Monday exam. I'm giving an exam in 106 today, and maybe we'll see. But at least in introductory astronomy, maybe where people are less motivated, I don't know. There was a standard deviation worse if it was an exam on Monday. And I think it's because people always assume they're going to study right up to when they fall asleep on Sunday. And there's another problem too, and that is we're getting further and further away from the material. But certainly if all four of you want to switch, and maybe even if three out of four of you want to switch, we could probably do something.
What do you think about that, Ken? It's been Tyler talked about it.
I'd be fine with that, I guess.
Fine, I'm not preferring fine?
Like, yeah, no, that'd be good. I think.
And I can always, you know, give it to you at a different time, a sort of thing, too.
Tyler, do you think about holding the test Monday?
So some people would be in favor of it, but we'll vote on it next time. You can give your cogitation on it. Whether I've given you my warnings about Monday tests, and maybe they don't. Well, I don't know. Senioritis. Maybe they do apply to seniors. Maybe they don't apply to you on this exam, and maybe the trade-off still might favor it. Okay, so we're finishing up chapter 3. In 339, you learned, I hope, that constants of motions were associated with symmetries of the Hamiltonian, or Lagrangian, if you want. And in what we just did, we showed this relationship between how something would change and the commutator of the Hamiltonian. So apparently constants of the motion in quantum mechanics are related to finding things that commute with the Hamiltonian. And actually in advanced classical mechanics, you can write basically exactly the same equation where instead of that being a commutator, it's what's called a Poisson bracket. So symmetries are actually associated with commutators or Poisson brackets going to zero. It's true that if we have that situation, it should also be associated with degeneracy, because you can show that if this is the case and we have one eigenfunction, then we can generate potentially a new eigenfunction by just operating with Q on it. Yes?
When you say constants of motion, are you talking about like the constants that come out in integrals, or like, I mean, in our normal motion equations?
Maybe yes, maybe no. So the standard constants of motion would be things like angular momentum, energy, momentum if there's no forces. So those may well come up as integration constants in solving differential equations, but that's not necessarily the case. So I hope you showed in mechanics that, for example, angular momentum conservation was associated with having a symmetry in angles. If there was a symmetry in angles, then there was a guaranteed conserved quantity that went along with it. My guess is that you did that. So one thing that might be a little bit confusing to you is we have not seen any degeneracy so far. That is to say, turns out that with maybe one counterexample, you don't have degeneracy in one-dimensional quantum mechanics. On the other hand, we have seen symmetry, right? We've had things that were left-right symmetric. So how did we avoid this suggested theorem that if you give me one wave function, I'll give you another one? Well, for switching left-right, for sending x to minus x, these functions were just plus minus the original function, right? They weren't new. They were eigenfunctions, but they just weren't new eigenfunctions. So we're not guaranteed that q psi will be a new eigenfunction. We're just guaranteed that it'll be an eigenfunction. But in any case, there's going to be potential degeneracy, and in fact, in higher dimensions, definite degeneracy when we have symmetries. And an example of that was the H atom from going back to modern. Since you did so well at remembering mechanics, you might remember that the energies of the H atom were minus 13.6 electron volts divided by the principal quantum number squared, and that each value of n was n squared degenerate. That is to say, we could have 3d, 3p, 3s, all of those had the same energy. And if you add them up, in fact, there are n squared of them. So when we have symmetry like the rotational symmetry in the H atom, you can see we are generating degenerate states. We have talked about the uncertainty principle, and we could have proved it lots of different times, but we've delayed it until we could prove it in general. And we proved this formula for any old operators A and B, and so in particular, when A is equal to X and B is equal to P, we get the so-called Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The delta T, delta E uncertainty principle is actually a little bit different because there isn't a time operator. Time is, you know, how things change in time, kind of not optional. It's required to go into the future. And if we defined our uncertainty in time as how long it would take a quantity to change by one standard deviation, then we could derive the corresponding energy-time uncertainty. It's really on a little bit different footing than the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So I skipped over this remark. In advanced quantum mechanics, you may well hear about the Schrodinger picture and the Heisenberg picture. And those two guys had kind of different ways of thinking about quantum mechanics, and they both thought the other guy's view was crazy. And in some sense, they're both wrong because they can be shown to be equivalent. And Heisenberg's take on this equation is a little bit different than Schrodinger's take on that equation, but it's a true equation, so it's going to be true in either one of their pictures. So I don't know if that's either here nor there. Turns out there's a Schrodinger picture, which kind of makes more sense physically. There's a Heisenberg principle, which is more abstract and more matrix-oriented. And there's actually something that's about halfway in between those two pictures called the interaction picture. And lots of calculations these days are done in the interaction picture. Questions? Okay, well, one dimension is kind of dull. How do we go beyond 1D? So here we just have one position X. Now we want to go to, you know, X, Y, Z as possible locations. And so instead of having just momentum in the X direction, if we generalize that to three dimensions, it's going to be gradient. And if we look at the Hamiltonian, you know, which was typically p squared over 2m plus some potential, well, now p squared is going to be minus h bar squared Laplacian squared. And we're going to have potential that's going to depend on position. We're still going to be interested in cases where h psi equals e psi, right? The eigenfunctions, because the standing wave eigenstate solutions are good for lots of things. But a whole lot of stuff is not going to change. So we've run into the Laplacian in E&M, and it might be worthwhile kind of describing what went on there. So in E&M, we weren't concerned with this equation that h psi equals e psi. We were often concerned with Laplace's equation, which was the Laplacian of the voltage was equal to zero. So they're not the same equations, but you know they both have Laplacians in them, so there might be something to be learned from it. So in spherical coordinates, our solutions were kind of the form r to the l and r to the minus l plus 1, right? A linear combination of those. And then we had these Legendre polynomials. I guess we called them p, didn't we? They're often called l. And it's going to turn out that the radial piece that we're going to have for quantum mechanics is going to be much more complicated. But these Legendre polynomials are going to be playing a role. So the one thing we did in E&M is we only looked at things that changed with angle, not with phi. And in quantum mechanics, we're going to want to have all of those possibilities. So we're going to want to generalize those things to have variation in both angle, north-south, and in longitude. And the upshot is we're going to get something that's like e to the I m phi, and then a polynomial that's going to depend on what you choose for m and n of cosine theta. And these things here are going to be called ynms of, and they depend on theta and phi. Okay, so Legendre polynomials are not going to disappear. They're going to be generalized when we go into quantum mechanics. In cylindrical coordinates, what we had was solutions that were of the form e to the minus n and e to the n, and then we had sine of n theta or cosine of, I'm going to use phi for the angle that goes around. And again, the angular part is going to become more, or excuse me, the radial part is going to become more complicated in quantum mechanics. And we're not afraid of complex numbers, so we're going to put these things together just as e to the n phi. When we were talking about rectangular coordinates, then we ended up with things that were sines and cosines and sinches and coshes. And turns out that basically the reason that sinh and cosh don't appear is because they're not normalizable, right? Sinh or cosh go to infinity as x goes to infinity. So the ones that are going to be of interest in rectangular are just going to be the sines and the cosines. So there is some overlap between E and M. It's going to be more than twice as complicated because we're going to have more complicated radial pieces, but the angular pieces are at least going to be related to what we had in E&M. Okay. So what we want to start with is a not very realistic, but occasionally useful possibility. And that is the case where this potential energy divides up into a sum of terms. So that this potential energy would be potential energy just of x plus potential energy just of y plus potential energy just of z. So I know that should seem pretty rare because, you know, most things depend on r, and r is the square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. That doesn't break up into a sum. However, one example of this is going to be the isotropic simple harmonic oscillator, right, where the potential energy is 1/2 k r squared, which is, of course, 1/2 k x squared plus 1/2 k y squared plus 1/2 k z squared. Another example is going to be the infinite, not the finite, but the infinite square well. So if we have a square well, so this is going to be the origin, and this is the x-axis, this distance is Lx, and this distance is Ly. If we think about what the potential is, the following potential works, right? That the potential as a function of x is equal to infinity unless it's equal to 0 if 0 is less than x is less than Lx. And the y is similar. It's equal to infinity except at 0 if 0 is less than y is less than Ly. So if you think about it, this actually works. For example, if I wanted the potential at this location, I would get 0 from Lx, but I would get infinity from the Ly. Right? So a spot like this, which doesn't work for both y and x, would also give me infinity, but it gives me infinity twice, but infinity twice is the same as infinity. Okay, so the square well can be, the infinite square well can be written as a sum of potential in the x direction and potential in the y direction. It doesn't work with a finite potential, right? Because if I try and make this work with the potential being some V naught if I'm outside the well, now it's V naught here, but it's 2 V naught here instead of being V naught. So this game only works with the infinite potential well. Another real important case where this works with is independent particles. So we haven't talked about it, but obviously if we have lots of particles, then we're going to have the location of particle 1 and the location of particle 2. And if there's no interaction between particle 1 and particle 2, then the potential energy is going to break up in the potential energy of particle 1 plus the potential energy of particle 2. Okay, so not a huge set of circumstances where this works, but particularly the independent particle case is pretty important. Okay, so if the potential energy breaks up, and let's just do this, we could do this in n dimensions, but it's going to be easier just to do it in 2 dimensions, and it's clear how this works then in general. So if the potential energy breaks up into 2 pieces, and of course the momentum is going to break up into the momentum of x divided by 2m plus the momentum of y divided by 2m. So in fact, the whole Hamiltonian breaks up into a Hamiltonian that depends just on x plus a Hamiltonian that depends just on y, right? So for example, this y Hamiltonian is going to be minus h bar squared, 2 derivatives with respect to y over 2m, plus the potential in the y direction of y. Okay, so what we're looking for is solutions to Schrodinger's equation, that h psi equals e psi. And we're going to do the usual separation of variable trick. We're going to try for a solution psi, which in general would depend on both x and y, that is just a function of x times just a function of y. And if we plug and chug our way through this, what we've got, h that just depends on x plus h that just depends on y times x that just depends on x and y that just depends on y. This all wants to equal a constant times that same function. And it works, you know, kind of like it usually does, right? So this Hamiltonian only depends on x, so this y can come out front of this Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian just depends on y, so this x is just going to be a constant. When you take derivatives with respect to y, it's just going to come out front. So what we're going to get then is y times the Hamiltonian of x operating on x plus x times the Hamiltonian of y operating on y, and that's going to equal e of x times y. Okay, so the next step is to divide everything by capital X times capital Y. And what I'm going to get then is 1 over capital X, the Hamiltonian of X operating on X, plus 1 over capital Y, the Hamiltonian of Y operating on Y. And that has to equal a constant. So this is only a function of x, and this is only a function of y. How can they be the same function, aside from a constant? Well, the only possibility is that this is some constant, and this is some constant. And therefore, the energy is just the sum of the energies in the x direction and the y direction. Okay, and of course, what either of these equations are is just the Schrodinger equation that you would have gotten from just looking at the Hamiltonian by itself. So the upshot is, if the Hamiltonian breaks into a sum of Hamiltonians, then the solution is just the product of solutions of each Hamiltonian separately, and the total energy is just the energy of the sum of the pieces put together. I think that's all kind of no surprise.
So you kind of solve it like two problems then and just add the solutions?
Yes. And for us, we've kind of done all the one-dimensional solutions that we're going to do. Potentially we're going to be golden. We will have already solved that one-dimensional problem.
And then we could just kind of use the formula.
We can just use the formula. So let's just use the formula. And I hope it's perfectly clear. We could generalize this to more dimensions. It's, you know, kind of no big deal. There's nothing special about the two-ness that we dealt with. Okay, so example one, the infinite square well we've just been talking about. Right, so this is something that is zero inside this box, which goes from zero to Lx, and it goes from zero to Ly, and the potential is infinite every place else. So we've solved this, right? So we know that the functions that we have for the x direction, they depend on an integer, which I'm going to call nx, but they were just the square root of 2 over lx sine of pi x divided by lx. And that's an orthonormal solution, right? That thing integrates out to 1 or 0. And the solutions that we had for y, they depended on an integer, which I'm going to call, oops, I didn't put in my integer. They depend on an integer, which I'm going to call ny. Oops, 2 over ly sine of ny pi y divided by ly. So, of course, the overall wave function is going to depend on which pair that I pick. And it's just going to be the product of these things, right? And I'm not sure you appreciate the problem yet, but we're getting three layers of subscripts. And those things start to get pretty tiny. Everything's a wave function, so kind of why bother to write it every time? So pretty commonly, I'm going to call this wave function the ket. I'm going to bring the subscripts up because that's what I care about. So I can call that the ket, that is nx and y. The corresponding energy is just the energy. I'll use this term energy in the x direction, which is okay, but remember that energy is not a vector, so maybe it's not okay. But in any case, the energy from the x direction and the energy from the y direction. So these were h bar squared over 2m was common, and then we had pi squared and x squared divided by lx squared, and we had pi squared and y squared divided by ly squared. Okay, so it all happens pretty fast. Let's check that these wave functions are orthonormal, right? So if I take nx prime and I take the integral of it with the unprime version, what this would be, of course, would be the integral from 0 to ly of y, the integral from 0 to lx of x. And then I would have the x of nx of x primed. Those things were real, so I won't bother to complex conjugate them, but maybe I should. But as I say, they're real, so it wouldn't do anything anyway. And then I have x of nx of x and y of n. Oops, that one's primed. And because this thing is a product wave function, those things are going to factor out, right? I will have an integral of x times an integral of y and those things were orthonormal functions by themselves, right? So this thing would only give us one if n prime x equaled nx. And this one would only give us one if n prime y equaled ny. And again, we've shown that for this particular case, but I hope it's perfectly clear that this would work for n dimensions and for any problem in which we had this separation, right? If we build up things out of an orthonormal basis, it's still going to be orthonormal after we put them together the way we have.
What exactly does it mean to have these? Maybe I'm just kind of getting lost in the notation, but to have delta functions with the subscripts like that, with the n prime x and nx?
So remember, so this is a Kronecker delta function. So all this is doing is saying that this integral will be zero unless this is the same number and this is the same number. And that was because this integral was zero unless these things were the same and those things were the same. So I want to do the following, and I hope I can kind of justify this to you. Typically, we have called this sort of thing a k. And if I just define that to be kx squared and call the other thing ky squared, then I have something that looks pretty familiar, h bar squared k squared over m squared. And it also provides a way of putting together these states. So if we, because things are labeled with two integers as opposed to just one integer, if we're going to kind of lay out these states, we need something that's basically two-dimensional. And one way of doing it is to make a lattice of states in this kx, ky space. I could also do the same thing with the whole number integers nx, but I'm happier doing it this way. So let me deal with the case as I've drawn it, where lx is bigger than ly, and that means that as I move up integers in k, they're going to be more closely spaced in x than in y. So I'm going to get a state, a series of states. So this one here, for example, is where k is equal to pi times 2 divided by lx, because it's the second state. Yeah, let me move this up a little bit. So this state here would correspond then to ky being equal to pi divided by ly. Since ly is small, it's bigger in that direction. If I go to ny equals 2, I'd get another sequence of states kind of like this. And the lowest energy state is the one that we're as close as possible to the origin. Right? The smaller the value of kx squared plus ky squared, k squared, the smaller the value of the energy. Right? So, I don't know, pretty obviously this guy has the lowest energy, and then this guy would have the next energy. Depending upon the relative size of lx and ly, this one might have the lowest energy, etc.
So this is kind of like arbitrary on how you set up your square well.
Yes.
Which side of it's bigger, basically.
Yep. So I decided to choose lx equal to ly. And if I had chosen them to be equal, then I would have symmetry, for example. And under those circumstances, for example, this state and that state would have exactly the same energy. So I would have degeneracy if I had symmetry, namely that lx equaled ly. But absent lx equaling ly, I've got this little bit of asymmetry. Now it's going to turn out next semester in StatMech, you're going to be very interested in the number of states that have an energy that's less than some particular energy. So that's kind of the cumulative fraction of the states. And you're going to be interested in the histogram of the states, the so-called state density, the number of states the derivative of the cumulative fraction. And one kind of good thing about this is we have a pretty good way of counting, or at least estimating, the number of states that's less than some particular value of energy. Because for any particular value of energy, it's going to correspond to a piece of a circle. Right? A circle that has a k radius that's equal to the square root of 2m, that energy you've talked about, divided by h bar. And although the details are going to matter, right, whether this state is exactly in or exactly out, we have a way of kind of estimating them, because each one of these states kind of occupies a cell. And we can calculate the area of that cell and calculate how many of those tiles are going to fit into that spot. Right? So each one of these states sits in a box that has a dimension that is pi divided by lx on one side and pi divided by ly on the other side. And so it has an area that's equal to pi squared divided by Lx Ly. And so the number of states with an energy less than E is just going to be the total area of the circle, quarter circle. So that's going to be 1 quarter times pi times its radius squared divided by the size of one of these tiles, which is pi squared divided by Lx Ly. And we're not going to be super interested in the results of this. This is more for next semester. So what we've got then is Lx Ly 1 over 4 pi times k squared, and k is equal to that. So this is Lx Ly 1 over 4 pi 2m e divided by h bar squared. Okay, so it just provides a way of counting the number of states that have an energy that's less than some particular energy. It is interesting that the area of the square well kind of comes out as an overall factor. So we could look at the number of states per area, per physical area of the box. And this would be proportional to the energy that you specify. If you think your way through this, and you will for homework, if you do the same thing in three dimensions, so you have a box as opposed to a well, then it's going to work pretty much the same, except we're going to end up with the number of states per volume being proportional to the energy to the 3/2 power. And instead of having one of these circles, it's going to be an eighth of a sphere. And we can use the famous dead physicist Fermi to name that sphere. So that's not relevant to this class, but that'll all come back to haunt you next semester. So it may also be worth commenting that this two-dimensional case is actually not crazy. You can make physically what are called two-dimensional electron gases by wedging various semiconductors of different doping and running them at low temperatures. And looking at the physics of these two-dimensional electron gases has been worth, two or three Nobel Prizes in the last couple of decades. And of course, it's pretty easy to make boxes. So the three-dimensional case goes back to Einstein. Okay, so that was example one. Example two is going to look pretty similar. So example two is the simple harmonic oscillator, right? We've said that also has this summation property. So the potential energy for, and we might as well just do this in two dimensions, but it's going to be the same in higher dimensions. The potential energy can be written as 1/2 k, which we've been writing as 1/2 m omega squared, x squared plus 1/2 m omega squared y squared. So I'm assuming that it's the same spring constant for x and y, that it's an isotropic simple harmonic oscillator. And so, right off the bat, we know that the solutions in one dimension depend on an integer. And these things were Hermite polynomials, and they had a particular normalization. We really don't care about the details, but I'll put it up here once. So this was the dimensionless version of x, and then we had e to the minus 1/2 dimensionless version of x squared. And the corresponding energy was h bar omega nx plus 1/2. Or the way we wrote it commonly was with the energy unit h bar omega over 2, in which case this was 2 nx plus 1. Doesn't doesn't really matter. And of course, we have the corresponding formula for y. So we can put these things together to make a overall wave function that depends on two integers. And it's just going to be the product of those two guys. And again, saves a lot of writing if I just elevate the subscripts to be on the normal line. Corresponding energy is just the sum of these energies, so it's going to be h bar omega nx plus ny. The two halves are going to come together to give me one. Okay, so I could rewrite my statement about orthonormality, and it works. It's going to work the same way, right? The x integral is going to separate from the y integral, and the only way I'm going to get one is if the two values of nx and the two values of ny match on either side of that integral. Notice that I've got degeneracy, right? Because 1, 0 and 0, 1 have the same energy, right? It doesn't matter whether this is 0, 1 or 1, 0, I get the same thing. And of course, lots of other similar sorts of situations. That degeneracy comes from the symmetry that we have for rotation around the z-axis. All of the usual games still apply. That is to say, I can talk about raising and lowering operators in the x direction. So x is equal to the dimension for x, which I usually don't care about, but here it is, square root of h bar over 2m omega, a dagger plus a. And the momentum in the x direction similarly was I, the square root of h bar m omega divided by 2, a dagger minus a. And I can have exactly analogous raising and lowering operators for y. Let me call them b. And I can, you know, if you want to figure out what the expectation value is of x between any of these states, you know, all of the usual things apply with these raising and lowering operators, right? So for example, if the raising operator in the x direction operates on this state, it's going to give me the square root of nx plus 1, and then it's going to increase x by 1. And just to write a different one, if the lowering operator on y, what we're going to get is the square root of ny, and then we're going to lower y by 1. All of those sort of good things apply. You might remember that these operators were basically made up out of derivatives of x and x. And so automatically, the commutator of a and b, or anything that is a-ish, like a dagger, are going to be 0. Yes?
Is b just then like an operator that acts on y instead of?
Yep. And obviously, if we expand this to 3 dimensions, which would be no particular problem, we could have a raising and lowering operator that's operating in the z direction. And I don't know, just to write it down, the corresponding energy then would be nx plus ny plus nz plus 3/2, right? Those 3 1/2s would get together. If we were to look at what these states look like, it's not exactly happy. So here's the origin, and here's x and y. I can try and plot out what the wave function looks like at different values of x and y. It's really kind of a three-dimensional plot, so it's going to be difficult. And maybe instead of plotting psi, I'm going to plot the magnitude of psi squared just so it's only positive. And if I were to do that, well, let's say I were to do this for nx equals 4 and ny equals 3, what I would get would be something like this. So this is where psi is big, is in these little bumps. And if I think about it, that's kind of how it has to be. The n equals 4 is going to have 4 nodes in x. The ny equals 3 is going to have 3 nodes in y. But what's odd about this is a rotationally symmetric situation. You would think the wave function would carry the symmetry of the problem. It would look rotationally symmetric. And what I promise you is that if I took linear combinations, for example, of these two degenerate states, I could generate a state which looked rotationally symmetric. So it's just a matter of basis whether these things look square or whether they look circular. Seems like a surprising statement, but it's true. We could, if we wanted to, the angular momentum in the z direction, the problem is symmetrical in this sort of rotation. And so it does turn out that the Hamiltonian commutes with the angular momentum in the z direction. And so if I operate on, you know, one of these states, I'm supposed to get a state that has the same energy, namely one with a 2 there. What in fact do I get? Well, it's not a huge amount of work to work out what this LZ operator is, right? Because LZ is equal to x times py minus y times px. And we know what px and y are, and we can work it all out. And after the dust settles, what this LZ operator is, it's proportional to AB dagger and BA dagger. Yes?
Why do we know that LZ is xpy minus ypx?
Because that's what it's been since 191. Right? So,
is L the angular momentum?
Yep. So R cross P and you work it out, you get exactly that. And you can see what this operator does, right? So this operator is going to increase the level of B by 1 and reduce the level of NX by 1, and it's going to produce a degenerate state, right? Because it's going to have the same sum of NX plus NY. And going the other way, increasing NX by 1 and simultaneously reducing NY by 1 is going to leave exactly the same sum. So it is, in fact, going to leave a degenerate state. Okay, so the degeneracy is caused by the symmetry. But in order to kind of make these things actually look circular, we're going to have to solve Laplace's equation in the appropriate coordinate system. But I repeat, what we choose for a basis can't fundamentally matter. This thing that looks square is a linear combination of things that look circular. Has to be that way.
Does this have to do also kind of with the fact that we chose our infinite square well to literally be a square?
So if we chose, so we're not, this isn't square well, right? This is simple harmonic oscillator. But if we chose our square well to be square, then Lx would equal Ly, and we would also have a very similar degeneracy and a symmetry that flips X and Y around. And you can show that that symmetry operator does in fact generate a new state, all of that same sort of stuff. So for most potentials that you can think of, those potentials are just functions of R. By that I mean the square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And so they have spherical symmetry, and so the angular momentum operator should generate new states that given one state, we should be able to use the angular momentum operator to generate a whole sequence of other degenerate states. And so kind of what's up next is to think carefully about the angular momentum operators and to try and make raising and lowering operators that change the energy in well-defined ways when I operate with Lx or Ly or Lz. In order to do that, we're going to want to prove lots of commutation relations, right? So the start for these A operators was looking at what x plus derivative with respect to x did, and looking at those commutation relationships. So we're going to be writing out the angular momentum and going to town on lots of commutation relationships of all of the angular momentas. And it can be a long process. I have some shortcuts to deal with it that do lots of them at once, which can be confusing, but I'll write them out next time. But once we get them, then we should be able to go to town. There's maybe one other thing that deserves comment, and that is, how do I know that the quantum mechanical version of R cross P has, you know, the P here as opposed to there? Generally speaking, in quantum mechanics, the order that things are matters. Whereas when we were doing it in 191, it didn't matter. And what's of course true is derivatives with respect to Y commute with X. So it doesn't matter what order they're in. So we are going to have that X and PY commute, whereas Y and PY were just like X. They're going to give us IH bar.
Can you go over what the commutator does exactly again?
Yeah. So the commutator of AB is the operators written in this order minus the operators written in the other order. And when we calculate commutators, as you have already done for your homework, it's often real convenient to put the function that these things are operating on so that things aren't just hanging around loose. So Y commutators, again, if we adopt Dirac's kind of abstract point of view, we're looking for the things that really depend on the operators, not the particular representation of those operators. And the commutators are statements about, you know, what the operators do in themselves. They're not dependent upon the basis. That is to say, you might remember that the X operator in momentum space is minus H bar over I derivative with respect to P. So whether I calculate the commutator in momentum space or whether I calculate it in position space, I still get the same thing. And this is actually where Heisenberg started. He started with he postulated the commutation relation between position and momentum and then kind of went to town with the resulting algebra, as opposed to Schrodinger, who wrote down the differential equation and then went to town on solving the differential equation, thinking about them as standing waves. So they came at things from totally different directions, but we're actually talking about the same thing.